Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, welcome back. It's 2018.
Well, happy new year to you, old Mark.
Happy new year. I know we've all taken a break for the holidays, and we're back at it.
Yes, we've been taking a break, but I've managed to be back to the UK twice and to South Korea, and it's only, what, January 19th?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've exchanged a couple of friendly emails back and forth, and I always get an autoresponder of, hey, Mona's out here. She'll be back with you shortly. And luckily, you're always quick to respond to me, but it's like, you know, where in the world is Mona Shaw?
Well, there's so much happening, and there's not so much happening. That's all I can say right now.
Exactly. And I know before we've had updates on what's going on with EB5, and we've talked with people on the Hill about what's going on and what could be happening. But today I know we're taking a slightly different turn, aren't we?
That's right. With starting the year in a slightly different way, because we are lucky to have on our show today as a guest, Suzanne Lazicki.
That's right, Mona. Today we do have Suzanne Lazicki on. Suzanne is a business writer and consultant specializing in the EB5 program. In the 8 years since founding Lucid Professional Writing, Suzanne has written over 200 business plans for both direct EB5 and regional center projects. She also runs the Lucid Text blog, providing EB5 news and information to readers around the world. And that's why she's here today, because she's the curator of all this information. Suzanne, welcome to the show.
I'm pleased to be here.
Suzanne, I have to tell you, it's not just all of us attorneys, but I would say that almost everybody, all the EB5 stakeholders, we just love your blog, Lucid Text, and we hold your blog as, you know, the authentic and the, oh, it's got to be right. It's been on Suzanne's blog.
Well, thank you. I did start the blog with the intention of just gathering information that would be useful for my business plan clients in using EB5. I do it not just out of the goodness of my heart to share information with others, but also because for me in the process of my work, I need to know the information about how EB5 is developing. And then my work becomes easier when the attorneys I work with, the clients I work with are also on the same page.
That's right, Suzanne. But there are other blogs out there, but your blog is so well informed. It really must take an awful lot of time. And you seem to gather your sources directly from the Hill. Do you read up on what's going on with Congress on a daily basis?
I would say that most of my information I do get from online search. And in my browser, I have a collection of about 50 links that I consult regularly. Some are government sources, some are other bloggers, some are industry sources, and I just read to see what's happening. And then when I report, I try to link back towards those sources so that people know that this is not just me giving the information.
That's her skill as a professional writer. She's always got to substantiate and cite the source of information. I love that. And you have a lot of information such as the I-526 processing times, which is constantly changing. I know you're sourcing Freedom of Information Act sources to compile this huge regional center list, EB5 FAQ. There's a lot of stuff on your blog.
But Mark, what's so interesting as well, that one thing I do love about Suzanne's blog is her opinions, because it's one thing just to put your data down, and it's another thing to read into it and give an opinion. And it may not necessarily be, you know, the correct. It is, after all, just an opinion. And that's what we all do. We'll find a source. For example, you could even look at the February visa bulletin and read in so much more than just the numbers. And it does take someone with a little bit of skill and a bit of understanding to be able to make these type of opinions.
That's right. So Suzanne, let me ask you, you've been doing this blog for 8 years now, lots of information. What was your personal evolution as far as putting your opinion on that information out there?
Well, I think that as I become more deeply involved in the world, I have some perspective on the raw data that someone who is new to it might not have. So I try to add that perspective as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things I can say, Suzanne, is that from your latest blog posts, is the fact that there isn't any movement. I think that speaks a lot. There's a lot happening with immigration in Congress, but not a lot happening as far as EB5 is concerned.
That is correct. I'm looking at public sources, and people are simply not talking about EB5 publicly. So this makes me interested to sort of interview you, Mona, because I think you do have some access to what's going on behind the scenes with EB5, and I'm curious to know what insights you have.
Well, yes, there is some information that I possibly can give out on this podcast. Right at this point, it does seem that the talks going back and forth between all the camps are a little quiet, and it looks like everybody is waiting for a final action on the new EB5 regulations, which are now set, I believe, to come out February 16th.
As of the time of this recording.
Yeah, February 16th, 2018.
And that may change in the next few weeks as things get pushed about. Or do you anticipate that those will get changed, Mona?
Well, I do believe that we will get something out on that date, but that doesn't mean to say that February 16th is going to be a date for change. I know people who are out there marketing are utilizing the date February 16th as the next deadline, mm-hmm. but according to all of the rules and regulations, you know, USCIS have to give a particular period of time. It's usually a 60-day period, so we would surmise if anything is going to happen, it's going to be at least maybe around about March, April time, or at least 60 days.
And I think it's important for people to remember, too, that there are sort of two balls to be watching. One is the issue of regional center program reauthorization, and then the other is the issue of EB5 program modernization, as they call it. So authorization is one thing that we're just depending on Congress. And then the modernization with changing the investment amounts, changing TEA roles, that's something that we could get out of either Congress or through the regulations.
And that's right. And as far as the regional center authorization is concerned, that doesn't affect projects which are direct EB5 projects. It only really affects anything which comes in through a regional center.
Well, Suzanne, it already sounds like you're keeping a good eye on what's happening with regional centers with regard to the authorization and the modernization of it. But what's happened with the visa bulletin? I know you frequently have updates on the visa processing times and the wait times, but what's going on with the visa bulletin?
Well, there are a lot of factors in trying to calculate how long we'll have to wait to get a visa number, depending on which country you're from and the number of applications that are coming through the system. For my blog, I ended up just putting together a multi-page Excel file where I keep a log of the information from the visa bulletin and also, more to the point, information on the backlog of visa applications at the visa center, and then also looking at trends in upcoming I-526s that will become visa applications to try to get a prediction of how long are people going to have to wait, considering the number of applications in the system.
That's really interesting, Suzanne, when you actually look at the last visa bulletin, because there are so many things that one can read through the lines. Like, for example, the fact that EB5 visa usage has absolutely surged over the last year by almost 37% in the last quarter. And the fact that Vietnam is likely to face oversubscription in this coming year, and most likely India in the following year.
Right.
So what does that mean with regard to those two countries, Mona?
What it really means is that they will not be current anymore once they get to the point where they are facing oversubscription, in the same way that China is at this point in retrogression. But China is a lot of years in retrogression, whereas I don't expect Vietnam or India to be in that same situation. But with India, their big issue, and again, it comes out in the visa bulletin as to why everybody's running for EB5, is because their EB2 and EB3 is so far behind. Right now, if you have filed an EB2, which is a skilled visa worker, USCIS are adjudicating cases which were filed back in December of 2008. So, you know, that's about 10 years plus.
Oh, my goodness. And they don't even have the E2 green card. So just rolling back from a visa to even a green card, you know, India doesn't have that E2 option. So EB5 continues to drive in popularity there.
That's right. So, I mean, I know we're going to be discussing more about the popularity of India on later programs, but at least these points do come out that you can read through the sort of the fine lines. And also, with the whole uncertainty of the EB-5 program right now, there is an indication that EB-5 visa interview appointments after January 19th could be delayed a little bit until at least we know for certain how far out we are going to go pending reauthorization of the program.
So obviously EB-5 is gaining in popularity for a number of reasons, but one of the things that really drives EB-5, at least the approvals, is a business plan. Obviously, Mona, I know you and your firm do a lot of the immigration paperwork, but you need a good business plan to really substantiate some of those petitions. And I'm so glad that we have Suzanne on to help us walk through some of the key items of a business plan.
Also, Mark, as I've just mentioned, the surge from India, Indians tend to do a lot of entrepreneurial cases. Suzanne, do you do a lot of entrepreneurial business plans?
Yes, I do. This past year, it was about half and half regional center and direct EB-5. Among the direct EB-5, I would say maybe it was about half for investors who were investing in their own businesses, and the other half were foreign investors who were putting money into a business with a local owner.
Right. We've seen this trend also. But I would say that the business plans for entrepreneurial projects are actually harder sometimes than regional center business plans.
I think that can be the case. There's a greater diversity of business types that tend to come up when I'm working with an entrepreneur. And also there's I would say even more weight put on the business plan in the direct EB-5 context, just because that is really a primary exhibit for a direct EB-5 petition. This is where it explains how is the money being used, how are the jobs being created.
No, exactly. Actually, you hit the nail on the head there. Because what happens is the reverse happens often when somebody is doing the entrepreneurial petition, in the sense that they will spend less on a business plan, thinking that it's not as important, when actually it's more important. What we find also is that people feel that, they try to cut corners here and there, and they don't go into details on industry standards.
If they do that, they will get back a request for evidence saying that your business plan is not credible because the assertions are not supported. So that's not a corner they want to cut.
You said that so politely. Vice, like, well, they can expect an RFE because they did a half job there.
Credibility is the big word. It's all about credibility, Suzanne, right?
That is correct, in my observation. One of my hobbies is to read AAO decisions, Administrative Appeals Office decisions, on EB-5 cases that were denied and then appealed. So I have a little collection of cases where the business plan had a problem and what that problem was. Credibility, I think, is the top reason why business plans don't succeed in the EB-5 context. And I can talk in more detail about the components of credibility that I've seen USCIS look for.
Well, actually, the legal terminology is probably matter of hoc compliant also. And when we talk about being matter of hoc compliant, I think really that is a byword for credibility.
That's correct. To quote from Matter of Hope, quote, most importantly, the business plan must be credible, end quote.
Right. So anyway, go ahead. Tell me what you believe that is the most important thing about being Matter of Hope compliant.
I think there are three main points: credibility from evidence, credibility from internal consistency, and credibility from external consistency. What I mean by credibility from evidence is, like what you were mentioning with industry standards, when the business plan makes a material claim, it should back it up by referencing something. So if it's making claims about the market potential, I want to be referencing market data that I source from reliable sources. If I'm making a claim about the financial projections and financial viability, I'll want to be referencing financial ratios and metrics from similar businesses. So footnotes with third-party evidence, that's going to help support the evidence from credibility aspect. And then consistency is the other big thing. That's, I think, one of the most common words that jumps up. I'm sure you've noticed this in requests for evidence that have problems with the business plan. And they're looking for internal consistency, which it means that if you say on page 10 that you're hiring this many people, on page 20, you better have financial projections that show enough payroll for those people.
Exactly.
If you say that you're going to have 105 rooms in your hotel in the business plan, the operating agreement better not say it's 115 rooms. So that kind of thing. And then external consistency refers to consistency with information that's available in the world outside the business plan. And I've seen increasingly that it looks like immigration examiners are going onto Google and checking. They're using Google Maps to look at the site. They're looking up information about the project. And if they find information on the internet that conflicts with what's in the business plan, they'll be asking questions.
Yes, you're exactly right. And also the USCIS IPO has famously identified all rhetoric, no substance, quote unquote, as one of the most common EB-5 business plan deficiencies. And they've stated that not only in their training manuals, but I've seen that particular sentence in RFEs also. But it really indicates that the emphasis is on detail and not length. But of course, you don't want a business plan which is like 4 pages either. Based on your experience, what content do you feel is not rhetorical but more concrete?
I would say relevant is the key point. It needs to be information that directly answers the questions that an examiner is going to ask in order to be able to determine that this is eligible. So detail on how the EB-5 funds are going to be used is relevant. Detail on either job creation or inputs to the job creation model, that's relevant. Information that shows that the business plan, including its market and financials, that is relevant. I think the problem is that a lot of business plan writers are a little bit lazy. They want to use the same template for every business plan, or they don't really want to write the market analysis. They're just going to buy some market report online that doesn't really have anything to do with, or doesn't have too much to do with the subject business, and throw it in there and call it a market analysis. That kind of irrelevant information is all rhetoric, no substance, as far as the purpose goes.
Yeah, excellent point. And also last year, there was a couple of stakeholder engagements, which we discussed to death on our podcasts. But last November, the IPO did mention that it is working to increase capacity by cross-training personnel. And that really means the economists and adjudicators are being trained to handle single petitions from start to finish. That's a stark contrast to previous approaches, especially when you have the same personnel handling a whole bunch of petitions and not just a single petition. The other point is that we are seeing is that 526 at the 526 level, adjudicators are looking at the economic issues present at the 829 level. Does that bring a different standard on board when you are putting business plans together?
Well, definitely. I do want to understand who is my audience for the business plans. Let's say when I first started doing this in 2009, 2010, the instructions I would get from the lawyer is that the people who are reading this business plan, they're not business people. They don't have a lot of business background. So keep it simple. Yeah. Don't put too much detail in the financial projections. Just kind of dumb it down a little bit. And now it's very obvious that they do have a lot of people at USCIS who have banking background, who are familiar with how to read a business plan, how to read financial projections. And for them, they need more information. In fact, there have even been requests for evidence and even denials where they complained there, for example, wasn't enough information about how the bank loan would be covered. There were loan amortization schedules. We would not have included that kind of detail 8 years ago, but now it's important because the audience has changed.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of cross-training going on at the Immigrant Investor Program Office, and that the adjudicators and economists and the various different roles, well, they're cross-training into each other's jobs so they can help, hopefully, shorten some of these processing times. Suzanne, you mentioned consistency throughout the business plan document. You don't want to state one factor figure in one portion and then a totally different factor figure in another one. So let me ask you this, again, keeping the cross-training in mind, and perhaps the person has a banking background, perhaps they do not. When you're writing your business plans, do you also try to present the information in a qualitative format where you're using the words to describe what's happening, as well as a quantitative format where you're giving charts and figures, and graphical format where you really expand on the charts for the people that just want to kind of hit the graphical highlights? How do you do that in your business plan and so that the adjudicator, depending on whatever their background is, or in this case, cross-training, how do you do that in such a way that to make it easier for the adjudicator to review and hopefully approve the plan without issuing an RFE?
Well, I would say there are two principles I follow. One, as you know, I called my company Lucid, which means clear. And I want my business plans to say whatever they're going to say using the fewest words possible, because they're going to be read by someone who is reading quickly. And for anyone to have something in the form of a table of bullet points is just easier to digest than seeing long paragraphs. So I try to do that. Then in the financial section, I try to split the difference by, on the one hand, putting in sophisticated financial projections, and then on the other hand, putting in extensive notes, so someone who might not be as familiar with reading them will still be able to follow it.
Suzanne, you bring up an interesting point. I know sometimes when people are looking at a business plan to substantiate their EB-5 petition, a common question is, well, how long should an EB-5 business plan be and how many pages is it? But what you've highlighted is really a key differentiator in that what probably makes you, your plans even stronger. And I love the fact that Lucid Professional Writing is named in such a way that you're focusing on clear. You know, the fewer words possible is better. You know, that's a key right there. Fewer words possible, better, because that's less for you to get tangled up in, perhaps have consistency problems, as well as make it easy for the person that's going to review it to read it, because
absolutely
they need to quickly review it and approve.
Mark, just to show how important all of this is for EB-5, you know how we have the top 25 lawyers and everything, which happens every year. Well, this year, and I believe last year, EB-5 magazine also did the top business plan writers, and congratulations, Suzanne, because I know you made it into the top five of the top five business plan writers.
Thank you.
Just one question that I do have for you, Suzanne. Obviously, you are doing business plans in all kinds of sectors. Are you finding it increasingly hard to do credible and sustainable business plans for projects which are in real TEA areas? I'm saying real TEA areas as opposed to some of the gerrymandered TEA areas we have, like Central Manhattan.
I would say that the business plan is not necessarily any more difficult. For me, maybe I have to have a little bit more patience, because sometimes the people that I'm working with in a small town in the middle of nowhere might not be as sophisticated, maybe in as far as the information that they would be providing upfront for the business plan. But for myself, I seek out those projects in real TEA areas because they're so satisfying to work on when, you know, I'm working on the first hotel in an area that has great tourism potential but hasn't been able to develop it, or I'm working on a new manufacturing business that's going to create a lot of jobs. That's just really satisfying to write about.
And it sounds like it also provides a consistency challenge, because if you are writing about something in a TEA area, say, to use your example, the first hotel in a particular area, earlier on in the document, when you talk about marketing, you can't say, oh, this is a huge boom area. You really have to point out to say that, you know, this is an opportunity in an area where it hasn't existed before. Does that present some consistency challenge when you're dealing with a business in a TEA?
Well, I would say that I do have in the back of my mind, because a business plan is also from one angle a story, and I want to tell a compelling story. So I will look at the aspects of this area that are distressed, and then point out the elements and the economic trends that nevertheless at the same time would support this new business going forward.
Do you see any indications, though, Suzanne, that people are trying to adjust to the new TEA guidelines, as in projects in those type of areas, you know, where you really would find an actual real TEA?
Well, my impression is that the market demand has been driving which projects are prominent in EB-5, and I can't tell that investors like investments in distressed areas any more than they have before.
Thanks, Suzanne. It is a real pleasure to speak with somebody who really does not only understand what's going on in EB-5, but really understands the EB-5 market also. And I really do congratulate you for that. And I have to tell you again and again, we love your blog, so keep it up. It's not easy to put down each and every detail. the way you do. And I have to commend that, especially nowadays, because we're with this particular day and time, we're talking about this whole government shutdown business.
Definitely. I have my browser with the news open, even as I'm talking to you. The situation is changing so quickly.
It is. And you know, even just yesterday, I was talking to some clients who were panicking and asking, is it going to make any difference? So it's something that I feel when you are doing it at real time, you really serve the purpose of the audience rather than just putting an article, which you could always put out, read out, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months or so later, but it doesn't have that same impact.
I'm sure we can all agree with that. Suzanne Lazicki, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshahlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.